ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Mike Pitts is a former rugby player and boxing trainer. But today he lives in the tiny country town of Turrawina, in the shade of the Warren Bungles in New South Wales. Mike lives on the town's aerodrome in an old timber airport house, which is very hot in the summer and super cold in the winter, but Mike loves it there. Mark heard stories about Turrawina and its aerodrome throughout his childhood, because this was the airstrip where his grandfather famously broke a solo flight record back in the 1930s when he flew from England to Turrawina to propose to his sweetheart Doris before another man could sweep her off her feet. Mark's granddad was Cecil Arthur Butler, and he was not only brave, he was entrepreneurial. He started his own airline based out of that airstrip in Turrawina. Cecil was also dyslexic, and so when Mark struggled with his words and letters and was bullied in the playground, his granddad was there to help, and he taught Mark how to box and how to stand up to bullies. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Richard. Love to be here.
Tell me about whereabouts in Sydney you grew up, Mark.
We grew up in a beautiful property that my grandfather bought for Mum and Dad to get them started with the family life. It was an idyllic upbringing, really. It was just such a beautiful place near the bush. We could go bushwalking all the way from our place all the way through to Middle Harbour, Roseville.
How much were you looking forward to starting school as a little boy?
Well, when I went to kindergarten, Mum said I used to always come home smelling of perfume because the kindergarten teacher loved me so much, so I had hugs and kisses all the time. So I actually thought going to proper school was going to be so fantastic. And I remember Mum put an ABC chart on the back of my door and used to go through the alphabet with me. So I was really, really looking forward to starting school.
What was the reality, though, when you got there?
Well, I soon found out it was a nightmare for me. And when I first was asked to stand up in front of class to read, I couldn't spell the word, and the teacher thought I was being defiant. So she started caning me. So that was a regular occurrence, and I used to hide that from Mum and Dad. I actually used to keep my socks pulled up because at times there were pretty bad marks on my legs. Anyway, once Mum found out, she removed me from that school and sent me down to Newington Lindfield.
Do we know anything about dyslexia in those days, or do we just think that kids were slow?
Well, there was still a lot of that. Only a few people knew about it. Actually, my grandfather was the largest donor to dyslexic research, and often I'd go up to his place and there was a Dr. Butler, an American lady from Sydney Uni, used to be up there having meetings with him, because he realised then that there wasn't a great deal known about dyslexia at that stage, and he was a woman doing research into it, so there was a better understanding about it.
What did it do to your confidence, not being able to spell?
It was horrific, and Mum used to always say, don't let anyone say you're stupid, but it sort of reinforced it. So, Mum, you know. But no, it was very hard, and that's why I was so lucky. Playing rugby changed my life. In term two, I walked into the school and I saw these goalposts, and I asked a friend of mine what they were, and I can still see those goalposts, and they changed my life.
So you had rugby, but were you bullied for not being able to spell?
Well, they just called me stupid, and, you know, it's the fact that they could see that every time I was being ridiculed by the teacher, you know, you must be stupid. And so there was a few that obviously saw me as easy pickings, but once my grandfather took me aside, he realised what was going on. He took me out the back and he said, don't tell your mother, your father or your grandmother what I'm going to teach you. But he said, don't wait for their mouths to open. As soon as their lips move, you hit this one, you hit that one, you hit the next one. And all I remember is going back to school the next week, and I was at the edge of the playground, just been alone. And all I remember is the teacher coming with these three kids bawling their eyes out. I don't even remember doing it. And they're just bawling their eyes out. And he just looked at me and he asked these kids, where are they? And they said, it's him. And the teacher said, well, where are the rest of them? No, it's him. And the teacher gave me this big grin and he looked at the kids, called them imbeciles and turned and walked off.
Was your grandfather a man you would often turn to for those kind of moments in life?
Well, my grandfather was the ultimate optimist, and he'd always talk about persistence, following your dreams and setting your mind to the things that you're passionate about. And there was just this steely determination about him. but he also was the most perfect gentleman.
Did he see something in you that other people might have missed?
I think so, and I think a lot of my temperament was like his. Yeah, he was very competitive, very, very competitive, and the relationship because of the dyslexia.
He liked to be called Arthur, but his proper name was Cecil Arthur Butler. And I checked him out on Wikipedia, and the entry is short, but this is what it says about your grandfather on Wikipedia. Cecil Arthur Butler was born in England and migrated to Australia with his family in about 1910. In 1917, he was apprenticed to become a tool jig and gauge maker at the Lithgow Small Arms Factory. In 1921, he transferred to the Australian Aircraft and Engineering Company at Mascot in Sydney. In 1923, he obtained his pilot's license. In 1930, he designed, built, and tested a small all-metal high-winged monoplane. And in 1931, he piloted a Compass Swift from England to Australia in the record time of 9 days, 1 hour, and 42 minutes. Did he tell you stories about his life in the skies when you were a kid?
He did. He used to talk about that. And he told me one time he was flying over the Pilliga. He had passengers. And he saw a dry creek bed and the plane had broken down. So he went to glide it down, seeing the creek would be the best place to land it. And when he got closer, there was boulders there. So he saw some dead trees. So he stalled the plane onto the trees and they collapsed and made a gentle landing but damaged the wings and they all had to walk out. There were all kinds of stories like that. And just the early days of trying to start the airmail service across to Adelaide and constantly breaking down and walking out, and the train would beat the planes. Just the hardships of the early days.
He broke that flying world record in a bid to get home in time to propose to his then girlfriend, who became your grandmother, Doris. What do you know about how he met Doris in the first place, Mark?
Well, he met at Barnstorm as she went up for a joy flight. And then often after that, he kept returning to Turrawina to see her. And my great grandfather, Doris's dad, he actually ran the general store there in Turrawina. He sold you all the goods. He was the doctor, the dentist, the undertaker. And he had a book and he'd actually go out to houses and people trusted him as the doctor. So my grandmother actually was the daughter of the most important person in town. And there's photographs of my grandfather refueling the Compass Swift out the front of the general store in Turrawina.
So he met her and took a real shine to her. Why did he then go to England?
Well, my grandfather was a very, very shy man, late developer, small, lacked social confidence, and obviously lacked confidence in women, and he was just so overwhelmed by being in love that it was very daunting. And he thought by separating himself, he maybe get over the problem, but it actually made the problem worse. So he'd been in England for 3 months and received a letter, which would have taken about 6 weeks to arrive from a friend, saying, if you don't return to Australia, you're going to lose your girl. And then the reality struck him that feeling awkward about being in love was not as important as losing her.
So what did he decide to do about it? How did he go about it?
Well, and he always says this, and he said that for some reason he travelled up to the Wirral and visited an aunt and uncle that he never met before. And when he was staying there, that's when he received the letter. And he jumped on a push bike and went riding through the countryside to clear his head. And then he saw a plane and he chased this plane all the way to this aerodrome. And just as he got there, another plane came in that really caught his attention, and that was the Compass Swift. This was a fellow by the name of Nick Comper. So he was designing these planes. And my grandfather, literally when he pulled the plane up, my grandfather spoke to him. And he built such a trust for my grandfather immediately, he let my grandfather take the plane for a fly.
So this is 1930, 1931, thereabouts?
1931.
1931. And planes have stopped being biplanes at this point. They're now monoplanes, these metal monoplanes. This is the revolution in aviation.
That's right. Well, the first steel monoplane, which my grandfather's the first designed airworthy in Australia, that was the year before. That's right. These are monoplanes.
So what plan did he then devise with this Nicholas Comper?
Well, at first, Nicholas Comper thought, well, why don't you come and work for me? And then my grandfather said, no, I really need to get back to Australia. And then instantly Nick Comper put two and two together and said, well, take this plane back to Australia, make my little sports aeroplane famous. And it's great for my business and get home to the prize.
Well, that's a nice thing to decide. But then there's the doing of it, to fly a small plane like that all the way from England to Australia. What was the route that he was going to take?
Well, he took the route. He went to Marseille first. Then he went across to Italy. Then he went across to Greece, to Syria, Iraq, over to Karachi, across to Calcutta, Rangoon, Kuala Lumpur, and then down through Indonesia to Darwin. And when he was about to take off, he was interviewed and he said he loved this little aeroplane. He thought it was the most remarkable small aeroplane produced. And he said, quite easily, I could break the record, weather permitting. And he had 5 days of horrific weather. And he was also wasted half a day in jail in Italy. And there was another.
Whoa, hang on. What happened in Italy? No, this is Mussolini's Italy, isn't it? So what happened in Italy when he got there?
Well, he'd landed on a Air Force strip in darkness, and they had no clue who he was landing there. The communication hadn't got through clearly to what he was trying to achieve. So he was taken and locked up in prison.
They would have thought he was a spy, I suppose.
Possibly, yeah. So anyway, they finally realised that he was actually genuinely trying to break a world record, because at first when he said he's flying to Australia, they said Austria, and thinking, don't give us that story. How could you be going, you know, landing here to go to Austria from England? Why would you come this way? And then when they actually realised, oh, Australia, they were going to let him leave then after keeping him in jail for that time. And then they made him stay in a hotel and fly in daylight. And he was quite happy to fly through any conditions at any time.
Because he had to get back to Doris.
Yep.
So then you said he entered a storm.
Well, he entered a storm going across the Mediterranean, and he was just tossed about. That was a pretty horrific storm. Then he had some dust storms going around Iraq, so he had more storms there with visibility and dust. Very, very difficult flying conditions. He had beautiful conditions flying over to Karachi in the desert at night with a full moon.
How did he talk about that?
It was almost like Alibaba on a rug, and it was just this tranquility and reflection. And he said, the mere mortals on earth never, ever get to see this. He just felt so privileged to be so alone but so in one with his environment.
And then when he got into India proper?
In those days, Karachi was still India. He had to fly across to Calcutta. And he'd said when he flew in the north of Queensland in tropical weather, he thought he'd seen the worst of tropical rainstorms. And for some reason, the southwest monsoon was running late that year. And he got caught in the most torrential downpour, tropical downpour. And he said that he had no visibility, but he found a railway line that he knew was leading to Calcutta. And he had to get the plane down feet above the telegraph poles going along the line. And he said that the weather got so bad that he could only see where he was going by looking underneath him as he crossed these poles one by one for hundreds of miles, and occasionally having to quickly swerve a bridge or an object. And when he was going through this mountainous area, he had to zigzag. But the concentration with the open cockpit of this horrific pounding that he was taking, I mean, it was incredible.
What, the rain lashing his face and lightning around him and all of that?
Yep. Well, just absolute severe. It would be like water torture.
So he got through the storm, found his way down through Indonesia, as you say, then to Darwin, and then to the airstrip at Turawina in New South Wales, just north of Dubbo. Tell me about his attempt, how he was coming in to land at Turawina.
Yeah, well, he got held up a couple of days once he'd broken the record in Darwin, purely because there were the local dignitaries that wanted him to come and see them, and he was tortured with these parties and things. And so eventually, coming into Turawina, he wanted to land in front of my grandmother's house. And every time he attempted to come in, the school was across the road. So the kids used to would run out from the school, run in the middle of the road, and he'd have to abandon his landing. But this happened several times, so he kept swooping in, and then eventually he realised. Eventually he realised he's going to kill one of them. So he went down to the paddock where the aerodrome is today.
And he landed, and there was Doris.
There's a little entourage, he said, of cars coming down the street and then onto the paddock, and then door open, and there she was.
Did she ever talk about this with you?
I don't remember talking about that initial moment, but she was so proud of him. You know, she'd always talk about he was a bit of a king to her.
So they got married. and they started a family. Tell me how he got into the airline business after that.
Well, my grandmother's family, the Garling family, had a lot of clever businessmen, and there was going to be a tender for the internal Empire Mail, so the domestic section of the Empire Mail, and there was 40-odd tenders for it, and my grandmother's family helped my grandfather form the tender, and they won the tender. This is in 1934, so this would be to take the internal mail, so mail coming from Melbourne and Sydney. And so they started the airline in Cootamundra because that was the point where the mail was sorted. And then he'd do a milk run to Charleville and then he'd hand the mail to Qantas to go on to England. It's ironic that he was the one to hand the first bag of mail to leave this country after he received a letter after 6 weeks coming by sea.
So he set up this country airline. What became of this airline after a while?
It was actually a bit more than a country airline because it was based at Mascot. So it started there and it wasn't long before he went to Mascot. He actually pioneered Gold Coast Airport. And I really believe that the Gold Coast Airport should have one of the terminals named Arthur Butler for what he achieved. I mean, Turawena was a major airport before Dubbo was. But he pioneered all the services out to Western New South Wales, northwestern New South Wales, up to southern Queensland, down the coast of New South Wales. So nearly every destination that you'd go to today was pioneered by Arthur Butler.
And what became of that airline?
Well, unfortunately, there was a man called Reg Ansett. And if Reg Ansett didn't take my grandfather over, it would have been TAA and Butler Air Transport, not TAA and Ansett. And on his third attempt in what was described as Australia's first filthy corporate takedown, he got the balance of power and took Butler Air Transport off my grandfather.
His entry, like I said, in Wikipedia is quite small, but it's kind of dramatic and really interesting. Why do you think his name isn't as recognised as other great Australian aviators like Kingsford Smith and Nancy Bird Walton?
Well, this is something that Nancy Bird Walton always said before she died, that he is the most understated aviator in Australian history. And part of my resurrecting the history in Turawena is to acknowledge his legacy because his legacy is up with the greats of Australian aviation. I think the main reason, my grandfather's a very humble man and he wasn't one to go to the social pages and do all that marketing of himself. He was a doer. He was more interested in running the airline and an airline that provided air services for everyone. So if you were in Bourke in those days and you wanted to get to Sydney, you could get to Sydney. If you were in Turawena and wanted a part for a farmer wanted a part, you could get it the same day as long as you contacted Sydney. If you need urgent medical services, and you lived in Bawarra and you could get a flight to Sydney. So he was more about, he was the people's airline.
So he did all this with his life and he was dyslexic himself. So I'm imagining this must have been a huge, Philip, for you, a hugely inspiring figure for you.
He was a total enigma to me. And just to be with him, to walk with him, I used to go for walks with his dog, Randy. He'd walk around Wurunga there and people would come to their fences just to say hello and he'd tip his hat to them. You could almost hear the whisper, Arthur's coming. And when I used to go to visit him at the house, there'd be people waiting to see him, people wanting to come and play chess with him. It was like he was a superstar. But the thing was, it was his simplicity that was so attractive because he was just such a simple, pure person.
So he taught you how to defend yourself in the playground and he encouraged you to play rugby. How old were you when you started playing rugby, Mark?
I was 7. And every time I used to go up to his place, he'd always say, he'd go and put a hose out in the back garden and tie some string on it. So we're going to go and do some goal kicking. And when we've done 10 in a row over the white string, we'll go in. And I loved it. I wanted to do it. And he said, because when you play for Australia, you're not only going to be the halfback and you're going to be the goal kicker and the captain. So there was always that in my head. And then actually the first rugby coach I had took me aside and said, you'll play for Australia one day. So it was just locked in my head, that's what I was going to do. And there was no alternative because that was just the way I'm brought up.
What was rugby for you then?
It was everything. I used to catch the train down as a child to Chatswood Oval and I'd watch all four grades of rugby. I'd watch every single player and I'd learn something from every single player. And I used to see some of the greats. I'd look at that amazing goose step of Russell Fairfax, and probably the one that struck me most one day I was watching this game in the pouring rain at Chatswood Oval, and Gordon were driving them all up to halfway. And then suddenly from the other side of the ruck, right near the sideline, spun this punched up version of Jesus Christ. And he came down the sideline. He had the fullback to beat, and he held him up with his most perfect in it away. And he slid and scored the try. And I just remember after that game, this guy, I don't know what it was. I just wanted to be like him. I wanted to be a walking, talking, living footballer. I didn't want to be anything else. And that was Ray Price. And Ray Price, I remember going home and Mum said, "What's wrong?" And Gordon lost by a point that day. And I just said it was Ray Price.
So you played club rugby. Then you played first grade rugby in England. You came back home and played first grade for Eastern Suburbs in Sydney against the legendary Ella Brothers. What was it that undid your career in rugby?
Well, I didn't know at the time, but there was a lot of talk that I was about to become an Australian halfback. I'd had a brilliant year at East. I'd won an award. I'd won quite a lot of man of the matches. And I was starting to feel that I had so much time and I was really wanting to step up to that next level. And there was talk that there may be a tour, and the president of the club, Paddy Rahilly, and the coach, Laurie Fay, took me for a talk and said, "You've got to stay fit because there's potentially a tour around." They never told me whether that was coming from the coaches or whether the club was pushing for me to get recognition, but I knew at the time that there was a lot of talk from the club side that I was worthy of going to that next level. So anyway, when it didn't happen, I did all this training in the off-season. I started doing a lot of sprint work, and I remember a really bad pain in my leg and hip, just a big jar, when I was doing some track work out at Hensley Field. And then I used to do hill sprints to the cottage at Centennial Park, and my legs completely collapsed underneath me. And then I started to get sharp pains in my back. And I remember starting the season to trial. I couldn't even get through training to do the trial, and the coaches, East had lost a lot of players, and there's a lot of pressure on me to play. And being a rugby player so close to a dream, I didn't see myself as anything else other than a footballer.
So did you try and ignore the pain then?
Yeah, and I tried to get through it, but I was starting to get really crippled. I was starting to get lame, but I was just pushing myself through the games, and I just started to lose form, and it was extremely humiliating for me.
Did you understand what had gone wrong for you?
Not at that time, because I had terrible sciatica, and I kept going to all these doctors. They'd x-ray my knee, x-ray my back, but they never ever went near my hip. And then my body closed down like a vice, so nothing was really moving, and I'd constantly have pain down my arms and my leg, and I'd be going on a football field. For the next 3 years, I'd stop playing. I'd try to come back, stop playing, try to come back. And early 1985, I played a first-grade game against Parramatta, and after the game, I couldn't even lift my leg 6 inches up to go on a bar stool, and I was in a lot of pain, and I just smiled to myself and said, "Well, you pushed yourself through that game. You should never, ever been on that field. But just stop punching yourself up. You've got to let go. It's over."
What was found to be wrong with your hip?
I had a severe lateral hip tear, but this was found years later because I gave up on doctors telling me, one of them actually said it was in my head, and he was supposed to be a very well-known doctor, sports doctor. And that was really crushing, you know, when I'm going through so much pain. I lost all the muscle in my left leg.
And when you had all the will in the world to be told it's all in your head, oh, dear.
So that was really difficult for me, and obviously my self-esteem was all around rugby.
And
so
were you exacerbating the injury by trying to push through it?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So you're just making it worse.
That's it. But there was no one there, and during those days there's no one there to even give you – well, there was no such thing as an MRI, and there was no such thing as having the support that they do, because it was the amateur days, and yeah, rugby was very raw in those days.
So what was happening with your state of mind in this period?
Well, yeah, I went through a lot of problems just trying to come to terms with the whole thing, and then trying to find a new direction of meaning in life. So at least I got to the stage now I'm letting go. I tried to coach for a short period of time, but I couldn't handle coaching. So I just knew I had to remove myself from rugby.
Broadcast. Podcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
So we were talking before, Mark, about how you had an injury to your hip that was terrible and only been made worse over the years, and it forced you to give up rugby, which is something you never envisaged at this point in your life, and so much of your identity was bound up in it. What did you do once you came to terms with the fact that your life in rugby was over?
Well, I was in business with my father, the travel company, and I started to put my energy into that, and my brother was a professional surfer, and he told me about this place on an island called Catanduanes in the Philippines. He said that he'd been told there was a fantastic surf break there. So I went to investigate to set up surfing tours there, and I found this location, and when I got there, there was absolutely no surf whatsoever. It was just flat ocean in May. And I just sat on this headland with a camera and waited and waited and waited for probably well over 2 hours, and then suddenly I saw this dark line out in the ocean. And the dark line got closer and closer and closer. And it hit the reef, and this perfect wave billed across the reef, and I got the picture. Took that picture home, and it made centerfold of the Winter Surfing Snaps magazine owned by Trax, and I named it Majestic. And after that, we got all these phone calls of people wanting to go there, and we started tours there. But actually, the first tour we took there, the surf was amazing the whole time. Anyway, on that island, I realised that the tourism side of it actually was causing social problems there. I thought, what have I created? You know, because once you go to a remote place and you start bringing foreigners, all the things come with it, like the marijuana, the girls and all that sort of thing. And I remember the local priest just staring at me, saying, what have you done? And I actually realised that surfers started fighting over the waves. And I caused a problem. I didn't, you know, certain people were happy they were making money, but it actually was a problem.
You thought you were introducing people to paradise, and they kind of ruined the paradise.
Well, it was like that, and there was only so much surfers that could go there. And also, yeah, it was causing social problems as well. Dad and I fell out in business in the Philippines, and I actually lived kind of like in the slums. I had to find ways to make money, selling boxing tickets to tourists, made some ice cream, sold some ice cream, did all sorts of things, but it taught me everything, because I wasn't living, I was surviving, and it was this hyper-vigilant life, and it really taught me a lot about myself. And I noticed there was a lot of children, street kids, in and around the local town of Virac. And while I was waiting at the airport one day, I saw a boxing gym, and I thought, Filipinos love boxing. Maybe I could start a boxing gym for kids there. And I met up with a big promoter in Manila called Gabriel Elorde, because his dad was the greatest Filipino boxer to date at that time. And he said, if you want to start a gym down there, I can give you a trainer to live down there, and I can build a ring and give you bags and everything. So I struck up a conversation with the vice governor, who gave me space in a government building in the town square. And then I got a cottage for the trainer to come and live there, and I would just send the money over and sponsor the gym. And if the kids didn't have anywhere to live, they could live with the trainer, and I'd send money over so they could feed the kids.
And were you happy doing that?
It was, because it was creating something, giving something. I actually felt more satisfaction out of giving than the commercial side of tourism. It also, when I went across there, I saw this young kid, and I just looked at him when he was training, and he was trying to get my attention. I thought, he's special. He's special. This kid's, I've seen great footy players, I've seen great, this kid's going to be something.
Who was this boxer? What was his name?
Arnel Baratilio. And I had to transfer my rugby skills into boxing training pretty quickly, because he didn't have a trainer, so I had to be his trainer. Eventually, I got Arnel to Australia when he was 18, this street kid. And before long, he was Australian champion and ranked number one in the world. And then Spike Chaney's management was very interested in me. And now I've got a very famous Australian Olympian boxer. I've got Arnel. And things just started growing, and I started to get a reputation of being a really good trainer.
Yeah, so you took Spike Chaney to the US and to the UK. What was it like on the boxing circuit in those days in the 1990s?
Well, I found my first trip to England was fantastic. I really enjoyed the old firm, the old British way of boxing. We fought at York Hall, Bethnal Green.
Was that when people used to show up wearing dinner jackets still in those
That's
days?
That's right. And you get all the old governors and all that round the ring. And we won that fight against Gary Shogun Logan. It was main event on British television. And all these old men got up and, well done, lads, well done. We won fair and square. There was just this honour about those characters in those days. And then we went to America after winning that fight. And we were offered to stay with the promoter in England, with Lennox Lewis, with the heavyweight champion of the world. And if we look back at that now, that option should have been taken. The management at the time thought going to America was a bigger thing. And Spike didn't fight that well in America. He fought a very reserved fight. He won every round, but it didn't attract the audience. So we lost the opportunity of getting a promotional contract in America.
How is the scene different there in America and in the UK compared to Australia?
Boxing's huge. You do have a really educated public over there. And promoting boxing in those countries is run by the networks. So big promoters, if you want to have events, you've got to get the contract with the network. So it's such a bigger market with a lot more people that know about boxing.
Yeah, it's like Norman Mailer was writing articles on boxing for Esquire magazine in those days in the United States too, wasn't he? So it was a much bigger thing over there.
Yes, and it massive tradition. You know, the heavyweight champion of the world was normally an American, and that was supposed to be the biggest thing in sport.
And how different was the scene in Australia, though, compared to that?
Well, it's a small scene, small promoters.
Seedier than over there?
There is that side. I think any of the lower-level promotions run by small promoters, they can get away with a lot more. You're fighting the promoter's boy. If you didn't knock him out, you're not going to win. Just things like that. But when you get to that higher level, that professional level where money's involved in giant networks, it is actually less corrupt if there's any corruption. But you've got your good honourable judges and good honourable promoters, and then ones that are in it just for the money.
So you had a daughter around about this time and you became a single dad bringing up your daughter. Was that why you decided to get out of the industry for a while?
Yeah, the early days, well, she used to come to the gym with me as a little girl, so she got to know all the fighters. She had a very interesting upbringing for a little girl, and then she got to know Johnny Lewis and Costa Zoo. She got to meet Jeff Fenwick, and then suddenly, yeah, she was about to start school, and I realised that I'd only had one boxer in the gym at that time who joined me after the 2000 Olympics by the name of Sakio Bicker. So he had two fights with me, and I realised that it's going to take me 4 or 5 years to get him to the top. I wanted Arnell to retire. So I thought this is the time that I retire and focus on my daughter.
What was it like to get out of that? Was it as painful as getting out of rugby?
No, it was totally different. I just felt that I've achieved beyond dreams to be able to come and just go straight into sport and so quickly get the kind of results that I got. You know, I had to be pretty happy with it. So when I'd taken the break from the sport, actually it became a really, really hard time for me because I was so used to the adrenaline world. I hadn't really addressed the fact that Dad and I had a bit of a breakup and I used to be so close to my dad, so it sort of affected our relationship. Also, just the hardships of living in the Philippines and then going through extremely difficult times with court cases and things, trying to get custody for my daughter when she was a baby. So I was drained. So actually, I had to confront a lot of personal issues in me. It became quite a toxic period in my life.
So after you'd done that, how were you brought back into boxing again?
Well, it was during that toxic period, I was speaking with a client of mine, actually Robbie Abels, was Sir Peter Abels' daughter, and she was a psychologist, and she just started me to think that I needed to pick up a book and read something. And I walked straight into this bookshop, and there was a book facing me called Medicine for the Mind. It was a Buddhist book, and I grabbed it, and I read it, and I said, this is what it's all about. And I told her that I got this book, and she said, I've got a friend who goes to this temple for meditation. So I went there and I must have been a bit spiritually bankrupt because as soon as I started meditating, I just saw this explosion, like a clearance in my brain. And I remember going to the gym the next day and everyone thought I'd had a new girlfriend. So I said, I better start learning to meditate. And I just worked on meditating and it really calmed me and it allowed me to get through so many of those issues. And then 4.5 years after I'd quit with Sakio, he's come to me and he said, Mark, will you come out of retirement and train me?
It's the Sakio Bicker.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I had this brand new tool, how to just get really focused and calm. And I had a little discussion with someone about it because I was a little bit nervous about going, because boxing world, you're either in it or you're out. You can't be halfway. And the energy that you have when you're in combat in the warrior world, because you're so focused and ready to go into these huge conflicts in a way. Anyway, so I decided to take Sakao on again. And by this stage, he was ranked in the world as a middleweight and he was the Orient Pacific champion. And we're trying to think, well, we try and get him a title defense of his Orient title in Japan. So we're trying to do that. And then Angelo Hyder, his Danny Green's trainer and promoter, contacted us and said, I've got him a fight if he signs a deal with me in Germany against Marcus Bae for the WBC Super Middleweight Championship of the World. So suddenly we're off to Germany. And Sakao was winning the fight and there was a head clash and Bae was cut under the eye. And the referee was called over by the promoter and he brought the doctor up. And there was a bit of shenanigans going on in the corner and they called the cut too hard to go on. And normally if it's a cut under the eye, they let the fight go on. But they stopped the fight. So Sakao came away with only a draw in that fight. And then we're off to America again for a Super 8 tournament with Showtime. And when we're in America, Sakao got an injury in sparring. So we went back to the hotel room and he fell asleep and he woke up. He couldn't move his arm. It was all swollen, the elbow. And we had to pull out of that fight. It ended up that he had fragments off a bone off from his elbow. And I said, don't worry, as we left the hotel, I said, we'll probably get offered to fight Joe Calzaghe or something in England. And sure enough, we got offered to go to fight Joe Calzaghe, the IBF and WBO super middleweight world champion in Manchester. And Joe Calzaghe had been the British Sports Star of the Year and the greatest super middleweight Britain ever produced. And we fought him in the men's centre in front of 22,000 people. And Michael Buffer was the ring announcer. He's the famous one for saying, the thousands in attendance and the millions watching around the world. Let's get ready to rumble. So this is the scene we're in. We've got 22,000 hostile people cheering against us and millions watching around the world on TV. And it was an absolute war and Sakao lost on points but gave him the hardest fight he'd ever had. And their promoter, Frank Warren, was running around the ring panicking, thinking they're going to lose the title.
It's kind of interesting being a Buddhist in the boxing world.
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm actually a Buddhist.
Or someone inspired by Buddhist philosophy.
I'm inspired by the philosophy.
And the search for peace as well.
That's right. And it's really, really funny because when you're actually in the gym and training and doing all these things, there's such a oneness. There's such a presence. I called it letting go of a sense of self.
Oneness in the combat, one against another?
Well, not so much that, but I always say that to the fighters, life's not about conquering others, it's about conquering yourself. And that opponent is only there to test you against yourself. So there's a deep respect between the fighters. It's the outside side of boxing that's not, it's the people taking opportunity, making money out of the athletes.
So when you say there's a oneness, what is that oneness?
To be at that level and to train and to get to know your movement and to be so internalized. It's very, very deep. It's very spiritual. It's hard to describe, but it's...
Do you mean like the command of the mind or the kind of the sinking of the mind and the body?
That's right. It's that total connection. And then your environment, because you bring in your environment to create energy. So you're actually bringing energy through your body to externalize it out in the art of combat.
So then you decided to give away boxing once and for all.
I just decided that it was wearing me out. Sakao started to get attracted to the Americans and the American promoters. So I just realized that relationship was drying up and I given boxing all I could give. And then slowly I started to realize I needed to get out of Sydney as well. My daughter had left home. I'd done my bit to bring my daughter up. I got her to that level. And I needed to think about my life in the future after boxing and where I'm going to live. I was coming to the end of the road. I was doing a physical business where I had to be training all the time and I needed to make a big decision. And that's when I started to go and spend weekends in Tarawina.
Why Tarawina? Why did you want to go back there?
Well, this is an interesting thing. People say, why are you going there? I said, I'm sowing seeds. And they said, what are you sowing? I said, I've got to wait to see them grow. And I realized that I'd gone through such a hard period of my life for literally 30 years, a tough life, living, you know, tough battles and swimming across oceans and getting washed up on the other side of the sea. Massive world title fights. It's big work. It's tough commitment. It's It's so different from the life that I grew up in. So I was looking for peace. I was looking for a safe place, obviously affordable place to live, a realistic place to live in the future. I realised I was ready. And I had my mum living up the road, and she used to go out to Turrawina as a schoolgirl, fly in with her friends and ride horses and stay in their house. So I just decided, and I remember I actually felt quite nervous about it. I'd only been there in 2008 for the first time ever. That was for celebration for the 70th year of the aerodrome.
And what did that town look like to you when you went there?
Just this tiny little place with just a pub and nothing else, but settled under the Warren Bungles, a beautiful location, absolutely beautiful place, Turrawina. People should go there.
And when you went to the aerodrome that your grandfather had made famous?
Well, there was something special there. It was this instant. It was something sacred to the family. Something I'd heard about as a child, and I realised it was the start of my grandfather's dream, and it was also the end of it when Ansett came along, because he actually terminated Turrawina because he didn't see it as financially viable enough.
So you thought, I want to live there. So what did you do about that?
Well, I just, one time after going up for the weekend and staying in the cabin at the caravan park, I just went home and I said, I've got to write a letter to the owner of that house, the airport house on the aerodrome where I live now. And I said, if you're ever interested in selling, because I said I'll be in Turrawina on the 1st of June. And he texted me about 2 days before and said, contact me when you get there. So I met him and it was pouring with rain. The place was a shambles, overgrown, garbage everywhere. And he kept saying, if I was ever interested in selling, and I could just see he's thinking, Arthur Butler's grandson, he's probably loaded. He's just thinking about how much money he could get out of me. But anyway, 8 months later, I took my mum and my daughter with me. My daughter decided to leave her boyfriend and come with me. And mum was living in a second floor apartment and she couldn't get down the stairs. She'd have back injury. The doctor at Northbridge was really upset that I was taking her out there. My brother and sister were really angry that I was taking her out there. She said, there's nothing out there. What are you going to do? Anyway, I got mum out there and her health started to improve so much. She was so happy there. All the memories came back and the beautiful location and the mountains around her, just all the childhood dreams came back. And she started to be able to walk nearly a kilometre up to the road and back on our driveway. And friends would come over and put barbecues on in the fireplace. We'd have the open fires. And she had a wonderful couple of years there, but the dementia hit in. And so we had to move her to Galar Hospital. But she lasted 5 more years when a lot of people only gave her a year or two.
And you're still living in that airport house at Turrawina Aerodrome. What's this house like?
Well, it's 116 years old. It's cypress pine and hardwood. Tin roofs, very high ceilings. Gets very cold in winter. We've had some zero temperatures. And very hot in summer, especially with the western sun hitting onto the veranda there. It's a beautiful home looking up to the Warren Bungles. And I can lie in bed if a plane lands early in the morning and see the plane just shoot past my bedroom window. I'm there alone in this big old house with 6 bedrooms. So it's a challenge to keep busy and stay mentally strong and keep fit. But I do some beautiful walks in the mountains. And I just love my drives along dirt roads, looking up at wedge-tail eagles, watching a goanna run across and just seeing that changing colours flicker across the Warrumbungle Mountains every day. It's never, ever the same. So it's a beautiful place. It's a peaceful place. And I found a purpose. I started off being a farmhand and then I got thrown the lifeline by a friend of mine who saw me in Coonabarabran and who worked for New South Wales Rugby.
And what are you doing with New South Wales Rugby now?
Well, I'm a development officer, so I feel this is such an important job because we are pioneering rugby to be a totally inclusive sport. We're accessing remote towns such as Coonamble, Walgett, Boorowa, Bourke, all that part. And we're making rugby accessible for everybody.
And this is an issue, isn't it? Because we're not talking about rugby league. We're talking about what is sometimes called rugby union, which is sometimes seen as a quote-unquote gentleman's sport.
Well, it's the mother's game. But if you look back at 1895, the Northern Unions of Lancashire and Yorkshire asked London, could we pay our players because we have a lot of working class players that can't afford to travel and play or injuries and time off work. And they said if they can't afford to play rugby, they shouldn't play. Now, the mother was a very, very cold mother. So the children ran away and formed the game rugby league. But what we've got now is a mother that's opening her arms up and saying, you're welcome, we love you, come and play.
How are you making it more inclusive then?
Well, we're going into primary schools in these towns. You've got a lot of town kids, you've got a lot of Indigenous kids, a lot of Indigenous population right throughout these towns, and say, come and play the game. You know, you're welcome, come and join our clubs. And we've still got barriers, but there's still some selfish people out there that want to keep it as a social club for parents, probably don't consider the kids and the actual social benefits of being totally inclusive. Because I think it's also going to help socially a lot of towns by rugby being that middle class sport, that it was something that only wealthy people could go and play. So I really think that all of us, every single human being that's involved and loves rugby and has suffered the pain of last year's World Cup, needs to contribute to and open our arms. It's bigger than the game to make it inclusive and help these kids get opportunity. Every child, black, white, brindle, rich or poor.
You can always, for those Indigenous kids, hold up the example of the Ellett brothers in the game. What kind of changes have you seen in the lives of some of these Indigenous kids you've brought into this program?
Well, there's the first school I ever had anything to do with, Galagabone Central School. And I remember a kid that I met the other day, so on one of our employment programs, she said, until you brought rugby here, we didn't even know what it was. And that I started teaching that school sevens through our New South Wales Rugby Development Program. We started teaching the sevens and we entered them in some tournaments and they were brilliant. And they actually qualified for the primary school championships in Sydney. And two of the boys got a tour of Newington and got scholarships. And one of those boys is playing for New South Wales Schoolboys at fullback this week against Queensland, Talis McEwen. And Talis has inspired a lot of kids. So we want to be like Talis. We want to go to boarding school. We want to play rugby. So there's more kids coming next year into boarding schools that we're creating programs for. And there's a couple of really, really special kids that are fantastic kids. And there's the opportunity this will give it will completely change their lives forever, change their families' lives forever. And it's helping to change their community's life. It's creating optimism.
You said when you had to leave the game of rugby because of your injuries, it was like leaving your spiritual home. Does it feel like you've returned to that spiritual home?
Definitely, and I feel I have a spiritual responsibility to the game, that everyone has the opportunity to play rugby.
Mark, it's been wonderful speaking with you. This is such a lovely story. Thank you so much.
A pleasure, Richard. So thank you for having me.
Mark Pitts. Mark is a former rugby player and a former boxing trainer. And there was a memoir that was written by Mark's grandfather, Cecil Arthur Butler, about his record-breaking flight across from London to Australia that he wrote some years ago called Flight to a Lady, and the family have just re-released this book. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.